introduce themselves.
I'm Brian Johnson. I'm from Enoch, Utah, and I represent the non-consumptives.
I'm Wade Heaton. I'm from Alton, Utah, representing just at large.
Sean Kelly out of Fillmore, Utah, representing the Forest Service.
Kevin Bunnell, I'm the Regional Supervisor for the Division of Wildlife Resources.
Mike Worthen from Cedar City. I represent the public at large.
Gene Boardman from Hinckley. I represent the public at large.
I'd also like to recognize two of our Wildlife Board members that we have here tonight. We have Donnie Hunter and Steve Dalton sitting in the back. Appreciate your attendance. We do have some other RAC members that will be coming. They should be here shortly. And then that will give us a full quorum. But we can go ahead with some of these informational items. Just briefly on the procedures tonight, if you have comments, we have comment cards in the back. Please fill those out, and there'll be an opportunity to comment for those after each of the presentations. Also, we have a period for questions, and we'd ask that you keep that period just to strictly to questions. Also, in this small room, we may have a tendency to speak without the mic, but we do need everybody, if you come up for a question, for a comment, all the RAC members, we need you to speak into the mic so we can get that on the record, just like we would in a large auditorium. First action item that we have is to...
Why don't you delay that until we have a quorum?
Okay. We'll skip that and go to the informational item, and so that looks like me, an update from the last Wildlife Board meeting. If you recall, that was on the big game. We had the bucks, bulls, and once-in-a-lifetime permit recommendations. That... That passed as presented, and which goes along with what we had recommended here in the Southern RAC. Also, with that, we had requested a number of action log items to be considered, and I'll go through those. But one of the problems was that the Wildlife Board chairman is leaving the board. His term's up, and he had a whole list of items he wanted to put on the action log. And so it was kind of hard to get a ton of those put on, but we did get some put on. Yeah, and if you're serious about these items, we'll do it again. Most of them got on, but there's a couple that we need to talk about. For instance, the first one got on, and that was real easy, the motion to investigate different ways of overcrowding in the Southern Utah units. That was real easy. They had actually brought that up themselves, and so that's on the action log. With Wade and the Poncegon, I think there's a little bit more work that we need to do. One of those got on, and that's to consider a rifle hunt for the velvet bucks only, but there was a couple others. One of them was to have the rifle hunt end on the 31st of each year. We tried to make a case for that, but we had maybe a hard time, and what they recommended was to get with a biologist, and probably also this other one on making the velvet bucks legal during the management hunt, and then have your biologist make a case, and let's pursue that a little bit more. So that those two didn't make it on there. They did make a motion to put on the action log, or actually they said that it was fairly easy to break out the draw odds for the kids qualifying for the 20% tags, and so I think that'll just be done, so that won't go on the action log. So we did do pretty good getting those on there, except for the Poncegon. We need to probably work on that a little bit more. The antlerless permit recommendations. We had made a motion to make some modifications on the beaver unit with the antlerless elk hunt. And actually, before the board meeting, those recommendations we had were added into the proposal by the DWR. And so by accepting the plan as presented, that included modifications to the beaver unit. And that was, that passed as presented, including those modifications. There was CWMU antlerless permit recommendations. Those passed as presented. The variance for the CWMU, if you recall, there was a presentation to make that variance, and that passed as presented as well. So that was good. That looked like a win-win for everybody involved there. So that's what I have, and I'll turn some time over to Kevin for a regional update.
Okay, thanks, Dave. First thing I'd like to do is introduce, we have a new conservation officer here in Washington County, Shane Kitchen, here in the back, comes to us from Daggett County, so it's a little bit of a population shock, even in southern Utah, and, you know, any red-headed, fair-skinned kid wants to come down to Washington County, so he's right at home here. We look forward to having Shane as part of our crew, and he'll do very well. A couple of things I wanted to hit. The ruling for Utah Prairie Dogs that came out of the 10th Circuit Court, there's still probably more questions than there are answers with that. If anybody has any specific questions on that, you're welcome to come up and ask and talk to me after the meeting or during a break. Fishing is good across the region right now, as it typically is, as the ice comes off, and there's plenty of opportunity for that. We have Free Fishing Day coming up on June 10th, and we will have events both at Little Reservoir up above Beaver and at Bryan Head, the little pond there at Bryan Head, for Free Fishing Day. I know Panguitch Lake's a place that a lot of people have interest in. It was netted by our aquatics crew yesterday, and it's in fantastic shape, just as they expected. Fish numbers and conditions look good. We're now 11 straight years without finding any chubs in our surveys up at Panguitch Lake. You remember that was a really big deal about a decade ago when we wrote node treatment at Panguitch Lake, and been hugely successful, even though it was pretty controversial at the time. It's something that we're certainly glad we did at this time, and the management that's going on up at Panguitch Lake is doing well. We're right in the middle of the turkey hunt. It's going well. Some information that I saw today that I thought was pretty interesting. 39% of the people that bought turkey tags this year had never hunted turkeys before. Seems to be, it's not something that people do necessarily every year, but it is one of the hunts that seems to bring new people into the sport and is growing, and it's a good way to get people interested and opportunities to hunt. And then lastly, I will mention that, and some of you may be hearing about this, we're being very aggressive right now in removing deer out of some of the agricultural fields and some places where they're causing problems. We do that unapologetically, because by being responsible in that aspect and trying to take care of places or crops and farmers and some in-town nuisance places, I firmly believe that that'll create more opportunities for more deer in the future. We've got to take care of the places where we have issues, and we try to time those very carefully so that we're targeting the resident deer. So we wait until after the migratory deer have gone back up onto the mountain, but we need to get it done before fawns are born, and so it gives us really about a 2 to 2.5 week window to be aggressive in doing that, and we've got a lot of sleep deprived biologists right now because most of that work's done at night, and they're kind of running ragged right now, but it's work that needs to be done. That's all I have, unless there's questions from the RAC members.
We still need to wait.
I think as long as
is...
Let's go ahead and approve the agenda. And as long as Braden's here before we vote on the first presentation, I think we'll be okay.
Okay. So I assume you've reviewed the agenda and the minutes, and I'll take a motion to accept those. Okay. From Mike, do we have a second? Okay. From Wade, all in favor? Okay, it's unanimous. Just one more thing real quick. We do have three RAC members that are coming off the RAC, and those three are not here. But I would like to thank them publicly for all their service. It's been an honor to work with them. Oh, do we? Oh, I guess we got one more to wait then. Okay, good. Okay, I'm getting ahead of myself, so maybe we'll get to see them one more time. So, great. We have submitted new names, but we haven't had any feedback yet on who the new members are going to be. And Braden's here, so we can start officially.
Sorry about that.
Okay, so our first the next action item is number 5. It's the Upland Game and Turkey Hunt table recommendations, and that'll be Jason Robinson.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Perfect. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jason Robinson. I'm the Upland Game Coordinator out of the Salt Lake City office. Going to talk about Upland Game and Turkey tonight. So what I want to do is up front is talk a little bit about what makes Upland Game unique. And so they are very different biologically from big game, and so we manage them very different than big game. Upland game experience boom and bust cycles that are generally short-lived. Many species of upland game live less than 2 years. Populations are largely dependent upon annual production and survival. Natural annual survival rates are low and can range from 10 to 40%. To say this in another way, in a healthy pheasant population, 80% of them can die each year, and the population will regenerate year after year. Hunters generally account for less than 10% of the annual mortality. So populations cycle largely independent of hunter harvest, and we use this term law of diminishing returns. And what this basically means is in years where the population of upland game is high, a hunter goes out, is successful, tells their friends, the friends are more likely to go out and have a good hunt. If the inverse is true, where the population is naturally low from weather or climate, same hunter goes out, doesn't have a very good hunt, tells their friends they're less likely to go out hunting. And so what we see is hunter numbers track populations pretty closely, which is basically an inherent protection for those populations. And so we can have liberal season lengths and bags that spread the harvest and opportunity over both time and space. So what this all really means, to kind of sum up, is a 3-year guidebook, which we're asking you to approve tonight, makes sense biologically. We don't want to be chasing population cycles each year. And it also makes sense administratively. One of the things to bring to your attention, because it is a 3-year guidebook, and some of the hunts have a fixed day opener, the morning dove, for instance, in some years, those hunts would be scheduled to open on a Sunday. And because we can't open a hunt on Sundays here in Utah, we're asking you to move that to the following Monday. So, for example, in 2019, September 1 falls on a Sunday. We would recommend opening that hunt on September 2nd, which is the Monday. So jumping right into the recommendations, we have 20 different species we're going to cover tonight. And so what I'll do is we'll present each species, but where we're recommending changes to the recommendation, we'll take a little more time to explain those. So starting with California and Gamble's quail, we are not recommending any changes to the quail hunt. And that's a statewide hunt with a youth hunt in October and a 5 daily bag. Chukar and gray partridge, we are not recommending any changes to that hunt. It's a statewide hunt, with a youth hunt and a 5-daily bag of each species. Ringneck pheasant. We are recommending a change to the ringneck pheasant. Pheasants forever approached us about the split season. So in the past, we've had two seasons for pheasants, a 2-week season that was statewide, and then a 2-week season that followed that was just on public lands. And what that's caused is quite a bit of confusion on private lands, because some of our leased walk-in access properties are included in that. And so what we are recommending is to do away with that split season and just have a single statewide season from the first Saturday in November to the first Sunday in December. Makes it a lot easier for hunters to understand the regulations and get out and harvest birds. We'd also recommend continuing with the youth hunt and a 2-male daily bag. Dusky and ruffed grouse. We're not recommending any changes there. That's a statewide hunt with a 4-daily bag of either species or in combination. Greater sage grouse. So we're not recommending any kind of a change here as well. We would like to continue with the permit allocation system currently in place. Just to kind of reemphasize, most of the state is closed to sage grouse hunting, with 4 areas open, and harvest is less than 3% of the statewide population. And then we'd like to continue to allocate 15% of the permits to youth hunters. So that's the 4 areas, and the bag limit is 2 per year. Again, not recommending any changes there. Sharptail grouse, very similar to sage grouse. We're not recommending any proposed changes there. But continue with the permit allocation system, allocate 15% of the permits to youth. 2 areas are open in the state with a bag of 2 birds per year. White-tailed ptarmigan, we are not recommending any changes there. That's a statewide hunt with a 4-daily bag. Wild turkey. Wild turkey are different than other upland game species, so we manage them a little bit differently. We like to evaluate hunter harvest data, and we've set up 3 performance targets. Each year we look at the 3-year average of hunter success, and we want that to be greater than 20%. We look at hunter crowding on a 1-to-5 scale, and we want that to be less than 4. And then we also look at 3-year average of hunter satisfaction on a 1-to-5 scale, and we'd like that to be greater than 2. So this is a graphic showing the total number of permits, the yellow line, and the total harvest in the black line. So you can see 2010 was the first year we started with the general over-the-counter season. So we've seen an upward trend in turkey hunters the past few years. Hunter success, the 3-year average hunter success is 32.3%, so that's above the 20%, so that trigger has not been met. Hunter satisfaction is a 3.8, which is above the 2, so that trigger has not been met. Hunter crowding is a 2.2, which is above the or below the 4, so that trigger has not been met. Of interest on this graphic, the green line shows the number of hunters afield. The yellow and black show the limited entry and over-the-counter crowding index. Even though we're putting more hunters out on the landscape, they're not feeling any more crowded, and that's really important. And part of that's just hunters over time learn to disperse themselves throughout the habitat. We also have expanding turkey populations as well, so more places for hunters to go. So to kind of sum that up, hunters are being successful, they're satisfied, and they're not feeling very crowded. So what we are recommending is no changes to the spring wild turkey hunt. A hunter can have 1 permit in the spring for a bearded turkey. With the COR approval, hunters with disabilities can ask for a 3-day extension. Continue with the limited entry hunt with 15% going to the youth. And then continue with the general statewide hunt, again with 3 youth days. So not recommending any changes there. So for the fall wild turkey, we're not recommending any changes here either. The main reason for having a fall turkey hunt is to reduce human-turkey conflicts. And this is in response to House Bill 342 that was passed a few years ago. Fall turkey hunts can reduce populations. And so used in the right way, they can be a real good tool for our biologists to reduce turkey populations where we don't want a lot of turkeys. And the contrast can be there as well. We don't want to have this broad hunt across the state because we still have areas in the state we're trying to grow turkey populations. And so the current system seems to be working quite well, and so we're not recommending any changes there. And this is an either sex hunt, so both males and females can be harvested. Snowshoe hare, we're not recommending any changes there. This is a statewide hunt with a 5-daily bag. Cottontail rabbits, again, not recommending any changes there. This is a statewide hunt with a 10-daily bag. Falconry recommendation, we are not recommending any changes there. It's a statewide season with 6 months long. So shifting gears a little bit, we're going to talk about migratory upland game species. There's an important difference here. Migratory upland game species are regulated through the federal system, the Pacific Flyway. And so we have additional restrictions through some federal laws that make us, or we manage these birds a little bit differently. There's five species: band-tailed pigeons, sandhill crane, American crow, mourning dove, and white-winged dove. Again, they're managed through the flyway process, and there's these additional federal regulations through the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. In addition, hunters are required to have a harvest information program, a HIP number for these species. And one kind of informational item, we're going to make some changes to the way hunters get their HIP number. Again, they're required for these five migratory species, waterfowl and geese. And so what we want to do is go to an online system so a hunter can get their HIP number on their smartphone in the field or their computer at home. We're hoping to have this in, or this will take effect this fall in August. And what it comes down to, it's going to be faster for hunters and easier for hunters to get that HIP number. So moving into the recommendations, band-tailed pigeon, not recommending any changes there. That's a statewide hunt with a 2-daily bag, and a hunter must obtain a free band-tailed pigeon permit. Sandhill cranes, not recommending any changes for three of the hunts, the Rich, Cache, and East Box Elder counties. We are recommending a change in the Uinta County area. We're recommending a change in the season. We met with some of the folks out there, and the cranes are generally there in October as opposed to September, so they get there a little bit later. And by moving the hunt back a little bit, they felt like it would be able to time the hunt when the cranes are actually there. And so what we're recommending is three 10-day-long seasons, with the first one opening on the Saturday closest to October 1st, and then three consecutive hunts in a row, with a bag of one per year. Mourning and white-winged doves, we're not recommending any changes there. That's a statewide hunt with a daily bag of 15. American crow, we're not recommending any changes there. That's a statewide hunt with a bag of 10. Migratory upland game falconry recommendation, we're not recommending any changes there. The board had two action items that they wanted us to address, so I'm bringing those to you guys tonight. The first one was to look at youth hunts on WMAs for upland game. So we created a list of those youth hunt opportunities and provided it in the RAC packet, so you should have had a laundry list of a bunch of different youth hunt opportunities. With that, we would like to make a recommendation to close the Pavant and Annabella WMAs to the general public on the second Saturday of November for a youth pheasant hunt. This is a hunt that's been going on for a long time. It's been going on during the pheasant hunt. For the most part, we haven't had any problems, but what we would like to do is get that information out in the guidebook and to the public so folks know beforehand that we're going to have that youth hunt going on there. So that's one recommended change there. The second board action item was to look at the order of the turkey hunts, specifically eliminate the limited entry turkey draw and replace it with over-the-counter. So we covered this, so just to reiterate, we are not recommending any changes to the spring turkey hunt. None of the triggers have been met. We've heard from quite a few sportsmen that like the way it is. And again, to sum up, hunters are being successful, they're satisfied, and they're not feeling crowded. So we're not recommending any changes there. A couple of housekeeping items. Rule 657-6, taking upland game. We made some minor editorial corrections, and then we made some corrections and clarification on baiting upland game to make it a little more clear and simple for hunters to understand. Rule 657-54, taking wild turkeys. Again, some minor editorial corrections, and then made the same corrections, clarifications on baiting wild turkeys. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the rack? Mike?
Yeah, I've got a couple, and I think I know the answer to one, maybe both of them. But anyway, you mentioned that there was recommendations to the migratory birds. Are those seasons set by the federal government or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, or is there leeway in there to set those?
So what the federal government does is give us the maximum that we can have. We can be more restrictive, but we can't be more liberal. So what we currently have is we offer the most liberal option that the federal government gives us.
So the dates, because and I've heard this for years, that the date on the opening for mourning doves is about a week too late, because we get a cold snap one day and they're gone the next day, and hardly anybody can find any that opening day. Is there any way to suggest that gets open a week earlier?
So that's actually defined in the Migratory Bird Treaty Act.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, so it's a not likely, I guess, is the short answer. It takes...
That's a Congress thing.
Yes.
Right.
Yep.
But the states do not have any leeway as far as the opening.
We can't open it prior to September 1.
Okay. The other one is ravens. They're everywhere. I mean, literally everywhere. And I was really surprised when the American Crow got onto the hunting list. Is there any way we can make recommendations to the Fish and Wildlife Service for ravens to put them in a hunt?
So ravens are managed differently than crows. They both fall under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, so they're both federally regulated species. With crows, they allow a variance to be able to have a hunt to basically address nuisance and depredation issues. That same allowance is not there for ravens,
mm-hmm.
And so we're currently have no options for a raven hunt. And there are ravens through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The state can apply for a raven take, which the state of Utah has, and Wildlife Services, APHIS.
Right, and you're talking about egg control at that point, but I'm talking about hunter.
There's no options
There's no option, and is there any way that the state can petition the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to consider that, or is that Congress too?
Yep, it takes a change of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act.
Okay, thank you.
Wade?
Jason, I was just curious, why did the Wildlife Board want you to consider rolling the turkey, the spring draw hunt, in with over-the-counter, making the whole thing over-the-counter?
You know, I wasn't at the meeting where this was put on the board action log, so I'm not exactly sure the conversation that led up to that request. So I kind of caught on the tail end. I think it was just looking at different options to see, and I think it sparked from some of the conversations on the youth hunt. But again, when we got looking into it, the majority of folks we talked to liked the current structure.
Gene?
So your the DWR's recommendation is to stay with the current structure?
Correct, yes.
Thank you.
Brian?
Just curious, what is the rule on baiting turkeys? You said there were some changes?
Yeah, they should be in your rack packet if you want to read them. We defined it a little bit cleaner in the rule.
In general, it's not allowed.
Correct. Yes. Yeah, so what Kevin said is, in general, you're not allowed to bait turkeys.
Okay. Any further questions from the rack? Okay. Questions from the public? All right. We do have a couple comment cards. One's just to read, and one would like to come up. That's Ron McIntosh.
Thank you, Rack. Thank you, Chairman. I'm with the Utah National Wild Turkey Federation. I'm here to represent the NWTF, and we 100% support the DWR's decision not to change anything with the turkey guidebook.
Okay, thank you. The other one's from Bryce with Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife, and they support the DWR recommendations as presented. So that's all the comment cards. We have comments from the rack. Okay, I'll entertain a motion. Brian?
I'll make a motion. We pass the Upland Game rule as presented.
Okay, do we have a second?
I'll second it.
Okay, we have a second from Braden. Braden? Any discussion? All in favor? That passes unanimous. Thank you. Our next action item is the falconry rule amendments, and that'll be Russ Norvell. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank the board, council. My name is Russ Norvell. I'm with the non-game avian program. So we cover everything from condors to T&E species to all the wildlife action plan species, in addition to the falconry rule. So I would start with a little of the history, since falconry rule has not come out before the RAC and board for over 5 years, and you may not be as familiar with this rule. This is the sport of kings, practiced for thousands of years in many cultures on many continents. In Utah currently, we have a total of 253 permitted falconers, with roughly 276 permitted individual birds, representing 26 species. 16 of these are native to North America. 10 are non-native or hybrid species. 5 of those 26 are conservation status species. So they're either a threatened or endangered species, a state-sensitive conservation agreement species, such as the northern goshawk with the Forest Service, or they are a Fish and Wildlife Service bird of conservation concern. And half of those 26 are also captive bred, too. So this is the rule covers a wide range of species. The states were granted authority to administer the sport of falconry in 2008 by the federal 50 CFR 2129. The federal rule is very general. It's the basement for all the states to build upon. States are allowed to deal with specific and local issues as needed. And as Jason mentioned, we can be more conservative, but we can't be more liberal. The rule has not been revised for over 5 years, and in that time we've had some new conservation needs, and we've also resolved some conservation concerns. The Utah rule's primary purpose is to govern the take of protected wildlife, including the collection and possession of falconry birds and the take of game animals. This is defined in state rule as the caring for and training raptors for the pursuit of wild game and for hunting wild game with raptors. The possession of non-suitable species that aren't suitable for falconry, are generally covered by the CIP rule, the collection and importation and possession rule. This rule covers three primary themes: the hunting with raptors, the take of raptors, and the care of raptors. But it also covers a variety of other activities, including the importation of non-native species to the state, abatement activities such as at airports, so it regulates a business. It also regulates the use of raptors, wild raptors, in captive propagation, which then can be sold. Hunting with raptors. Raptors are considered to be a type of allowable weapon, like any other division hunting season. The rule allows for, however, a little differently, though, the take of protected game species, primarily upland game and waterfowl, but also allows for the take of unprotected species and for the creation of special hunting season for falconry meets. The take of wild raptors for falconry is limited by several existing federal and state statutes. The Federal Falconry Rule itself, the Endangered Species Act, the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act, the Federal Birds of Conservation Concern List, also by tradition and history, by the falconer experience level, and more recently by state conservation concerns. The care of raptors is also laid out in rule, both for standards of care for the individual birds, standards for facilities and inspections, and also for when and where inspections can be done, given that oftentimes raptors are housed in people's actual private property, in their homes. Our current rule has three experience-based classes of falconry permits. The apprentice, which has allowed one bird from just a few species, and only adult birds. That's a three-year time frame. The general has to practice for 5 years, and they are allowed up to three birds with more species and more ages of birds, so they can take younger birds as well. The master falconer can have multiple birds from any authorized species. There's a special endorsement that's required for golden eagles currently, and that's going to be extended in this proposed rule to a variety of other species as well. So it becomes less of a golden eagle exemption, more of a special exemption for large raptors, basically. The list of authorized species for each class is important for both legal conservation and practical reasons. Our current rule has some issues. Excuse me. Our federal standard is kind of a one-size-fits-some approach, and we've found it to be hard to follow, enforce, and to administer. And our current state rule is currently quite long, complex, and somewhat unique to the division, because it does, in fact, use native and non-native birds to take protected wildlife. It allows possession of CIP-limited non-native species. You can import species that are otherwise precluded by another rule. Allows the take of high-priority conservation species, which are also precluded by from other actions, and allowed special ad hoc license locations and seasons as determined by the board or director. So our goals were three. Basically, to invite the public into the process so that we had a no surprises approach overall. We intended to simplify the rule, to clarify the language and intent, and ideally to shorten it. Although it's been pointed out that I think we're back about where we started for the length. Ultimately, though, we wanted to make it easier to use, both for the falconers to be in compliance, for enforcement purposes, and quite honestly to make it easier and cheaper to administer. So in terms of our public engagement, we held many informal outreach efforts with three large open houses. I think we peaked at around 50-plus folks attending at least one of those, with over 10 other additional meetings with constituent groups, UFA in particular, the Utah Falconers Association, and other individual falconers. We've addressed well over 60 specific issues with the rule. We've addressed many issues with the administrative procedures of how the rule is implemented. That's if you look at the red line copy of the rule, you'll see a lot of this red ink. What's before you is the product of a considerable consultation. We've responded literally to hundreds of comments. Again, the goal was to simplify this, to clarify the language and intent. So we grouped like sections to streamline the rule. We rewrote sections to clarify the intent. We updated language to match the Fish and Wildlife Service's Birds of Conservation Concern List. This is of special note. The list we've been working with is a 2008 draft or a version, and 11 species are affected in Utah under that rule. There has been a, in 2015, the service finalized its new draft, routed it for internal review, and then in 2016, states got to review. In 2017, we were still waiting for DC to approve that. That list of 11 conservation concern species will drop to 4 for Utah, and we are looking forward to the approval of that list since we also agree with the conclusions. We think a lot of those species are no longer of concern and should be removed. We also updated references to the upland game and pen-reared bird rules to make sure our rules are in alignment. Third goal was to make it easier to use. So to clarify processes and lines of authority, we updated administrative processes and methods. Primarily, we built a database. We corrected all of our contact lists, which had been scattered on separate spreadsheets, unconnected. We added things as basic as email addresses, and we updated all of our forms, and we're making many of these online now. We've also added language to protect falconers in case a legally possessed bird status changes, so say it gets listed as threatened or endangered in the future. We've added the allowable take of adult American kestrels because for master and generals, because the current rule is hard to comply with, and it's also hard for our law enforcement folks to enforce. And we've clarified lines of authority so that only authority derives from the division director or the wildlife board. There had been some older references to the program coordinator, which were removed. So, in summary, we have a number of small changes. Our initial edits had shortened the rule by over 5 pages. I think we've backslid some in the final. But that was our goal. We have over 80 edits and corrections to clarify the intent, fixing citations, fixing confusing sentences. The biggest piece, though, is that we've incorporated the authorized species or pre-authorized species list into the text. That had been a table that was left outside on the website and not incorporated into rule as proper rule construction requires. So this is one of the major fixes for this rule, technically. It's why the rule got longer, not shorter, ultimately. As I said, we've corrected rule construction to current standards and restructured sections there. All these changes set us up to do some things that are not in the rule itself, but we're shifting to online COR application processes, adding falconry CORs to the DWR app, shifting to online annual reports, and, as I mentioned, updating the falconry database, basically bringing the program up into the current day and age. The big changes, however, so we've increased the number of pre-authorized species from what the table had listed as 14 species to a much larger number. The federal rule allows for any of 3 families of hawks, eagles, or owls. Most of these are non-native to North America. Our proposed rule, pre-authorizes 32 non-native species and 23 native to North America species. And we've also defined a process by which more can be added by request to the division director. We've also reduced the waiting period for peregrine falcon and other sensitive species permit draws from 3 years to 2. And we've allowed the eagle endorsement for the general class falconers to get the eagle endorsement so they can have large non-native species. This also functionally erases the difference between general and master class falconers in terms of what birds they can possess. So the changes to the pre-authorized species list. Current rule, the apprentice class is allowed 14 species. This is much more liberal than many of the western states. And the proposed rule would increase that to 15. The general class would go from the current 14 allowable species with multiple age classes that aren't available to the apprentices to 44 species for the general. And the master would go from the current 15 species to 45, with the one species of allowable eagle to 11 species globally. We're using eagles in a non-specific taxonomic way to describe very large raptors of that same size class, if you're going to talk aircraft carriers or something, you know. So, why do we need a list? This has come up a variety of times. I should mention that this presentation is modified from the initial presentation because of in response to some questions that we've received from RACs along the way, but that the rule you're voting on is no different. That the proposal has not changed at all. But some of this language we've tried to insert some of this to help clarify. We have overlapping rules. The CIP rule and the falconry rule allow and disallow the same species. And this is one of the reasons we need to have clarity for our law enforcement guys to be able to show what's allowed and what's not. This also, having a list of pre-authorized species allows us the opportunity to minimize risks, both from wildlife disease, ecological risks, legal or human health and safety issues. These are all part of our mandate. These are not, in our opinion, large risks, but there are something we need to attend to as a public agency. But fundamentally, the pre-approved list of species allows us to deem what species are suitable for falconry. There are a number of individual species that would be allowed under the federal rule that are inappropriate and are under the state definition for falconry, for use in falconry. If it's an 8-inch tall insectivorous nocturnal owl, is not like the flaminid owl, which is one of the species that was requested. This is not, in our consideration, a species that's appropriate for falconry as the state defines it. The question was earlier asked in one of the racks, this is one of the new slides, was how would new species be added? In our current rule, in the draft, it says make a request to the director with a COR application, and the director will make a decision, basically, or designate. We wanted to flesh this out with some more detail. It's the same process we've used to evaluate the large list of species that we've evaluated thus far. The division staff will accept a COR application. If it's a suitable species for falconry, then on to the next. If it poses a risk to human health or safety, there's a process for that, evaluating that, that we've used. if it also requires a health inspection or health certificate for import by the Department of Ag. We also have to consider if the species escapes into the wild, can it establish a viable population? And this is a matter of review with experts and local biologists as well. And that's the gist of our proposal.
Thank you. Questions from the rack? Wade. John, go ahead.
When you talk about adult birds, are you talking about Passage and Haggard? So anything older than Ayas?
Yes, all the above. These rules affect all Passage. For those who aren't falconers, probably. So Ayas are nestlings. Haggard are adult breeders. Passage are first-year migrants.
Okay. So when you're talking about kestrels, so master and general they can get, now they get a passage bird.
They can now get a haggard bird, actually.
Haggard bird. So
it's allowed in federal rule to take haggard adults, but it's those adult birds, because you're taking your bird out of the breeding population.
But an apprentice still has to take a passage bird?
Correct.
So it's too hard for a general or a master to tell, but not for an apprentice?
It is, but it's specifically precluded by federal law.
Okay.
So we don't have any flex on that.
Wait.
I fall into that non-falconer category, so bear with me.
Please.
I actually did read through the rule, and your goal was to take out the confusing sentences. You failed on some of that. I'm just kidding.
We tried.
You did fine.
In our defense, I will say that our current rule, and in both its forms, echoes as much as possible the federal rule that we started with. And some of that language, and quite honestly, some of the inconsistencies are inherited.
That's still not bad. It probably made more sense to other people who are a little more familiar. I did have one question, though, with the classes of the permits, the apprentice, general, master. You mentioned there's a special endorsement for eagles.
Yes, sir.
What is the point of that? Give me a little more detail behind that, if you would.
The eagle endorsement is basically a certification that you have the experience handling and caring for large raptors, so that you don't hurt them or yourself or anybody else in the process. So you've got to build up some experience with smaller birds and over time before you get a letter of recommendation. There's a series of process of recommendations and from other falconers who have large birds. You can get experience in a variety of ways, by volunteering, by helping to handle large birds from other friendly falconers. That's how you get that endorsement.
Okay, so it actually you can get a current permit, one of these three classifications, and still not be able to have eagles.
That's
you have
correct.
To have that endorsement.
Yeah. And currently the take of wild golden eagles is quite limited by the service. It's at this point it's very difficult to get a wild golden eagle.
And that is mainly regulated by Federal Fish and Wildlife?
Correct. Yep. We have tried to clarify the process in this rule so that's more clear about how that could happen if it ever did.
Mike.
Who's next here?
Yeah, I know at one time there was, I guess, a move, or maybe it was more than a move, but allowed the take of golden eagles or capture of golden eagles for falconry purposes when they were depredating on livestock. Is that still the case? And there's a list, the Fish and Wildlife Service goes down when they have one that needs to be removed from the wild?
Yes, sir. And we have not had a wildlife depredation area delineated in Utah, as I believe ever. There is a new part of the process that came as a result of this rule revision, was that the governor can now designate a wildlife depredation area, which wasn't allowable before. However, before a bird can be taken from the wild, the service will require a variety of steps to be taken first, including hazing, trap and relocation, and then, after all that, you might be able to get on that list. That, quite honestly, behaviorally, a golden eagle that is hazed and then trapped and relocated is going to be very trap shy and tough to capture, no matter what. And there's lots of better places to go at that point. So it doesn't make it very easy to get a golden eagle at all.
One comment on the use of the word take, because you're talking about taking prey and then taking a castrol, and I think I followed you, but may want to clarify that.
Sure. When I'm using the term take, it's from the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and from the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. The service talks about take as removing a bird from the wild. And I should say that falconry birds are considered to remain wild even while in possession. They are not owned by the falconer. They are merely housed, cared for at that point.
Jane?
Different than... Sorry.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I need a little more education on this falconry thing. You talk about... the wild ones. Is there falcons that aren't wild?
Yes, sir. There's. Falconers can use captive bred, pen-raised birds, essentially, as well for falconry, and that includes a wide variety of species that are not native to North America, for example. Or they can also raise birds from that are captured from the wild and brought into captive propagation. And then they're no longer wild.
If one's taken from the wild, what's its life expectancy or useful expectancy as a falcon?
That varies greatly with the species. But I think the general consensus, both in literature and in practice, is that birds in captivity probably have a longer lifespan than they would in the wild. Much like a zoo animal, you know, you have these age records from that. These are well cared for the most part. These birds, I think it's well established, these birds live quite a bit longer in the wild, in captivity than they do in the wild. And many falconers will capture a bird, use it for a season or two, and then release it again. So it's kind of catch and release, if you will.
Thank you.
Is that...
Any questions down here, Sean?
Hey, Russ, just want to mention this was one of the most difficult rules I've ever dealt with, and you've gone a long way to simplifying that, so it's much improved over what it was. But, I'm just curious, was there a committee that was associated with this revision? Did you run this by?
A public committee or?
Yeah, know, made up with, I guess, Falconers Association and Audubon. Were they kind of involved in the rewrite of this?
We primarily consulted with UFA and Falconers in the ramp-up to the rule revision, and most of the text and modifications were as a result of quite a bit of consultation with them. Audubon's were consulted more after the rule was drafted. The first draft came out in late November, however, and that's when the Audubon's first got a viewing at that point. There wasn't any particular rationale for excluding anyone, but there wasn't a formal process of inclusion either. Does that answer your question? Okay.
Any other questions? Okay, before I open it up to the audience, we just ask you if you come up at this time that it's for questions only and that you use the mic on my right, your left. And then we'll follow up with comments. So we'll, if there are any questions from the audience, please come up and state your name.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Justin Searle. I'm a master class falconer with 15 years of experience and here representing UFA. Russ, in the information that the RAC has received, I mean, based on this slide alone, it looks like a good thing for falconers going from 14 species to 54 species. Why is UFA against your proposal in doing this list, and what is the argument here?
Well, I think that's. I won't speak for the UFA, but okay. I mean, I know where you're going with this.
Understood. Just trying to summarize the
ahead.
List of questions.
I understand. You got 5 minutes.
So, with this list of 14 species, we're going to. You say currently we need to include this in the list of falconry rules. What's the legal status of that list of 14?
That's one of the issues with the rule. The rule was constructed probably improperly back in 2008, and then again in a revision in 2012. By maintaining the list of allowable species outside the rule as a web page, the intent was to make it more make it easier to change, to update, without having to go through the full RAC and board process. However, in doing so, my predecessor inadvertently did not follow proper rule construction, so it is a little unclear right now. We've gone back through the minutes from the 2012 and the 2008 RAC and board process. It's unclear whether or not the rule itself is enforceable. That list of 14 species. We have spoken with the coordinator and gone back over some as much of the materials as we can find as to the intent behind that, and it was in fact intended to be the list of allowable species. However, in the current rule construction, its enforceability is entirely questionable.
Okay, and specifically in the Utah falconry rule, exactly how many species are actually currently permitted in the falconry rule that is legally enforceable?
Potentially, it would be the federal basement, the 500-plus species that are available in those three orders globally.
So basically, any raptor with some specifically noted exceptions.
Correct. Yeah, there are several species, for example, Stellar Sea Eagle, Golden Eagle, et cetera, that are Bald Eagle, that are specifically precluded or have extra restrictions in the federal rule. But other than that, it's the anything goes three orders of raptors global.
And is that list of 14 species, is that referenced anywhere in the Utah falconry rule?
Nope, it's not.
Okay.
Again,
so does this
correct?
Does this slide accurately represent the Utah falconry rule then, the current rule that we have enforced today?
This represents our current policy and practice. It does not well represent perhaps the rule itself.
Okay, so 14 species are currently permitted. How many species do we currently have represented in possession here in the state of Utah today?
As I mentioned in the first one of the early slides, we have 26. I'll go back up. There we go. 26 species, 16 are North American natives, 10 non.
So approximately 12 species in addition, above and beyond the 14 species actually listed.
Yes, all these species were approved for by a coordinator, sometimes my predecessor, for use in falconry. So that the current rule allows the falconry coordinator, a person in my position, to approve an application for a COR for a raptor species, even if it's not on that list of 14. And that's happened.
And does the division actually have a paper trail of every single instance of those extra 12 species? The actual request by the falconer before possession and the approval response before the falconer took possession of the bird?
No, we don't. We have actually, unfortunately, somewhat poor record keeping for a period of time. And like I said, that's one of the reasons we've built a database to help improve our tracking of all these requests and approvals, et cetera.
Does the UAFA and the Utah Falconers believe that the list of 14 was ever enforced in the state of Utah?
Well, again, that's for the Utah Falconers to say.
All right, thank you.
Perhaps it'll be a comment period later.
Any other questions from the audience? Okay, we'll go to the comment cards. And we have two. And we'd ask you at this time to keep your comments to 5 minutes. And the first one is
Martin Tyner.
Martin Tyner, followed by Justin.
See if I get this down. I'm sure.
Sorry about that, guys. Okay, yes, my name is Martin Tyner. I'm a master falconer. I am an eagle falconer. I am the first person in North America licensed to trap and train a wild golden eagle for falconry. I am a federally licensed wildlife rehabilitator. I've been flying birds for nearly 50 years. So I've got a pretty good handle on what falconry is. Falconry is a little bit more the history than what they've talked about. Falconry started more than 4,000 years ago. Falconry is so intimately involved in the human experience that the United Nations has declared falconry as a World Heritage activity. So it's far more than hunting. It is truly a lifestyle. I think if you guys have read through the proposed falconry regulations, probably the thing that you notice more than anything else is I'm sure glad I don't have to do that to go deer hunting or to go pheasant hunting. Or, you know, we are the most highly regulated field sport in the country and probably in the world as well. So you have to kind of accept the concept that if you're willing to read every book you can find on falconry, pass a written test administered by the state fish and game, like most government tests, the test is extensive and badly written. Once you pass the test, you have your facilities inspected, and then you go through a 2-year apprenticeship just to become a general class falconer. That would show a dedication, a level of dedication that allows you to do things that the regular general public aren't allowed to do, if that makes sense to everybody. Now, the problem that we're having with the falconry list of approved birds of prey, let me put it in a kind of a different context. Someone in the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources decides that we're going to regulate the shotguns used for hunting upland game and waterfowl. And we're going to make a list. And we're going to make a list of 50, 60 shotguns that will be approved. Any shotgun that is not on the list, you not only cannot hunt with, you cannot import into the state, you cannot have it in your possession without making an application and request to the director of the Division of Wildlife Resources. That's what we're looking at. We're looking at the concept that, you know, here's a very small list, and I'll be honest with you guys. Here. Birds of prey of the world. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of birds of prey. In this book, I would, for myself personally, I would basically say that at least 90% of the birds in this book are not, in my opinion, usable for falconry by my standards. But who am I to make that decision? If somebody wants to fly a bird that I think is absolutely worthless in falconry. And within the falconry list, they have the Northern Harrier. Now, the Northern Harrier is this little, lightweight, little glidey thing that eats frogs and lizards and mice. Is that an appropriate falconry bird? In my opinion, no, but that's on the falconry list. Yet there are hundreds of birds that are would be qualified for falconry that is not on the list that falconers can have. And I was the curator of Birds of Prey at Busch Gardens in California, and I have flown all sorts of exotic birds of prey in my lifetime. And if somebody were to come up to me and offer me through a zoological facility something really exotic and really wonderful, something that I've never ever worked with, well, before I can accept it, I have to make application to the director of the Division of Wildlife Resources, whom himself has, without justification, could say no. Just like this particular list, there is no justification for this list. For the vast majority of the years that I was a falconer, the list was basically falcons, hawks, eagles, and a couple of different owls, and that's what the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, that's the list that they give. Now, as far as simplifying the falconry regulations, when I first moved to Utah, I came to Utah because I wanted to get away from the oppressive regulations that I had to put up with in California.
America.
There we go. And so I moved to Utah, and when I moved to Utah, the falconry regulations, one page. Okay, and every time they redo the falconry regs, guys, the goal is to simplify and to clarify and to shorten.
We got 1 minute, just
okay.
So you know.
38 pages. I would highly recommend that we do not pass that particular. I mean, most of the falconry regs is fine, but that particular list is a big problem. Is a big problem for that small group of a couple hundred falconers, and it's going to make it very difficult to practice. In fact, even the national organization, if that list is passed, NAFA, the North American Falconer Association, will no longer come to Utah and bring their national meat to Utah because they'll be bringing birds that they can't bring in. In fact, currently, like I said, I have a golden eagle. I have a goshawk. My goshawk is half Finnish, half Apache. I have a harris hawk. I have a prairie falcon. And so even my goshawk would be questionable as if it would be legal. And, of course, bringing my goshawk into the state of Utah, the only approval was I just fill out the normal my normal import permits that we do for any other bird of prey, send it up to Salt Lake. It's automatically approved. There was no question. There was no consideration. This is a captive bred falconry bird. You can have it. And unfortunately, with passing this list, that will no longer be possible. So I would highly recommend, please, and if you have questions about falconry, I'm here. Please ask.
Thank you. Our next comment is Justin. How do you say your last name?
Searle.
Yeah, so Justin Searle, representing UFA. So 5 minutes?
Sure.
Okay.
Want to pass this out?
So, and first, we definitely want to say thank you to Russ, because Russ has been great to work with, and not only has he addressed many of the issues that we've been concerned with inside of the current Utah Falconry Rule, he's also made a lot of changes that are very positive changes to the division, addressing different staffing issues that have been a hindrance, as well as creating the database and really putting the division in order for falconry. So we really, really appreciate it to Russ for that. Just really briefly, On the part of UFA, UFA, you've heard all the reasons pretty much why that list of 14 birds is disputed, and why the list of 54 birds is something that we stand up against. To give you a little bit of history, just very briefly, UFA actually helped and sat down with the division about 10 years ago to actually create that initial list of 14 birds, which actually wasn't originally a list of birds that were specified by species, even though memory of some individuals appeared to change. But that was a list of recommendations for the birds, and they were native birds, native species here. The falconry rule at the time actually allowed for those orders of birds as well. So with that list, there's also question. In fact, to tell you the truth, the Utah Falconers Association and almost every single falconer that still over the last year has found out about this list of 14 birds, it's a kind of a shock to every single one of us that was ever there. Of those birds that were the 12 species above and beyond that list of 14, I've spoken to several of those falconers. Not a single one of those falconers ever had to request that species to be permitted and to be able to get an approval before bringing that bird in. All they did is filled out the appropriate paperwork and mailed the paperwork in to the federal government as well as to the state, which we have to do within 5 days of either purchasing a bird or taking possession of a bird from the wild. Really briefly, in regards to what's wrong with having a list of 54 birds in the first place, well, if the goal was to try to simplify the list and to simplify the regulation, trying to teach a DWR officer to specify and be able to recognize the difference between 54 different species is something that I can tell you right now, of the 256 falconers currently in the state of Utah, almost every single one of them would struggle to be able to actually recognize at least half of those 54 species. So it, in no way does it actually simplify and make easier to enforce the falconry rules or regulations. The DWR has not performed any biological studies here in the state of Utah to justify that NEIS. There's been no justification for why that list is needed from a biological study perspective. And when it comes down to health, human health and safety as well as diseases, there haven't been any diseases that have been identified in the state of Utah that's ever been brought in by a falconry bird. In fact, if we bring a bird into the state of Utah, we actually have to get a health inspection from a vet and bring in a certificate from a vet. And there's only two sources of locations where we can get these birds. We can buy or we can request a permit from the state to trap a bird that's local here in the state, or we can buy from a breeder that actually is under the U.S. federal regulations on what they can actually breed. So it's already regulated and limited what we currently have. The list of 54 species does not include all the birds that are currently in use inside of falconry. That's the reason why NAFA, who brings over $300,000 worth of revenue to the city of Vernal when they hold their meet there every 5 years, has stated that they will not come back to Utah if that list is enforced, because there are birds being used and hunted nationwide that's not included in that list of 54 birds. In fact, within 100 miles of where we stand today, there are breeders that are actually breeding birds for use in falconry that are not on that list. There was mentioned earlier about eagles. Russ mentioned how difficult it is to get an eagle. I've been a falconer for 15 years. I will be submitting all my paperwork to my eagle endorsement this summer. However, there's no way for me to be able to get a golden eagle here in the state of Utah. I actually am forced, if I want to fly a large raptor, to go to a breeder and actually purchase a bird through a breeder that is a large raptor that I can actually use here in the state, because there's no other options that are available.
Down to 1 minute.
Okay, thank you. Just really, in summary, the list of the 54 birds really seems to be more of a solution looking for a problem than actually trying to address any problem that has been documented by the DWR. And so the UFA kindly requests the RAC to go ahead and to present the motion that we've actually placed before you and vote affirmative to accept all the DWR changes in the falconry rule as presented by Russ today, with the sole exception of the list of 54 species, and instead revert the list back to the current Utah falconry verbiage and wording that allows for the three orders of raptors, which is easier to enforce and what has been in place since 2010. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, that's all the comment cards. Do we have comments from the RAC? Okay, Mike.
Let me just mention one thing. Mr. Tyner is a very highly respected individual in southern Utah as both a rehabilitator and an educator to the public schools and one that we really trust his judgment on. And so I really question if there is a need for 54 species, you know, what was the division trying to accomplish by making the list? And maybe you can answer that, because I'm a little, you know, if there wasn't a problem before, are we creating a problem by making putting sideboards on a list?
Certainly. The list of 54 came from discussions with the UFA in their prior administration, where we discussed one of the changes that we'd like to do is incorporate the list of 14 into the rule. There was discussion and objections to that, and she said, well, if you don't like the 14, what would you like? Send us anything at all. We got a list of 74 species that were requested. We evaluated those with basically one slide here. How do I get there? Let me get back to that. There are four criteria. Basically, in addition to whether or not is the bird legally possessed and legally possessable under federal law, basically, fundamentally was, is it suitable for falconry? And as the state defines it, we regulate hunting practices. We don't regulate lifestyles. So there's a mismatch inherent to how the extent of the division's purview the sport of falconry, I fully acknowledge, is much larger and much broader than what the division is legally mandated to authorize and to regulate.
The 54 species that are being suggested, is that because there was other species that were undesirable coming in and the division had to limit that so there was nothing slipping in between the cracks? Or
well, the list dropped from 74, the 74 requested to the 54, primarily because of birds of conservation concern. There were some other species that were deemed unsuitable for falconry. Like I mentioned before, nocturnal insectivorous owls do not meet the state's definition of falconry.
Has the falconers tried to get those type of birds in and use them, or is this...
Not to my knowledge, no.
Okay, and there's really not a problem there with the falconers as have gone through the certification process and whatever else.
Correct, and we also added a process and tried to make it as clear as possible as to how additional species could be added without having to go through a full rack and board process.
Okay.
Like you would have for a CIP rule.
Russ, is the intent here, I mean, there's certainly falconers are dedicated to their sport, and but they're not all the same. Is part of the intent with the list to keep people under the auspices of falconry from just bringing in birds that are essentially a pet?
Yes. There's a different process for that under the CIP rule. If someone wants to possess a bird that's not suitable for falconry and fly it on, it may be fine, but it's not falconry, I guess. And that's better regulated under the CIP rule for possession.
So with that, and I'd ask Martin to respond to this as well. You know, the comparison you made with regulating shotguns, to me this is more like regulating, and we've had people come and ask for crossbows and for air guns and for atlatls and for all sorts of different weapons for harvesting wildlife that we've said no to because we didn't think that they were ethical or for some reason didn't meet the definition of hunting. To me, that's more the comparison that's here rather than saying you can bring in this shotgun but that not that shotgun. What we're saying is you can bring in a shotgun, but you can't go hunt with an atlatl. And I'd ask if you would agree with it. That's maybe a more straightforward comparison here.
Well, basically, I would disagree with it a little bit. Falconers, to the best of my knowledge, and like I said, I've been doing this for almost 50 years now, and there are always bad people in every group. I mean, there, I can think of a very, very small handful of people that I've met in the last 50 years that if you guys were to take them, put them in jail, and throw the key away, I would be thrilled. I really would. And
that's in every sport that's out there.
but you know, the Falconers themselves, you know, it is truly their lifestyle. And the problem with the list, like I said, my Finnish goshawk isn't on the list. And yet, there's lots of breeders in North America that breed Finnish goshawks, and the northern goshawks that we have here in Utah are in decline. Their populations are stressed. Now, I could have gone up this last spring and gotten me a northern goshawk from the mountains up here above Cedar City. I've got three goshawk nests to choose from, but the populations are stressed. I don't want to take a hawk from a stressed population. So I'll go ahead and spend the money, drive to California, and purchase a Finnish goshawk so that I don't have to stress the native population, but I couldn't do that with that list. Does that make sense? And so the problem with the list is if you stay with, as originally intended, you know, hawks, falcons, eagles, and there was only a couple of owls, if you stayed with that, you don't worry about the little flammulated owls. You don't worry about that. And for goodness sakes, if you don't want somebody flying a little screech owl or flammulated owl hunting insects, you don't want them flying a northern marsh hawk on frogs. But that's on the list. So it's just silly the way that the list is done.
Okay. Thank you.
Wade.
So Justin mentioned that of the 256 falconers, half of them would have, or a majority of them would have a hard time listing half the birds on the list, half of the 56. I would have a hard time listing five. So I just want to come right out where I'm at. I don't understand a lot about falconry, but I do understand the principle that is at work here. I believe very much in Brian's America. And I also sit on a county planning and zoning commission, and give me a little liberty to explain a principle that we have that we wrestle with every month. The principle is this: do we list all of the accepted uses, the permitted uses of a piece of property, or do we list all of the uses that are not permitted? You see the difference there? I strongly believe that if we don't have a problem, why are we limiting? Why are we adding restrictions, taking rights away from people that clearly there does not seem to be a problem? They seem to govern themselves pretty well. Again, I don't have a dog in this fight, but I do want to uphold the principle behind this. I appreciate where these guys are coming from.
Braden?
My thoughts are very in line with Wade's, actually, on this. And I guess what I'd be curious about, Russ, is just to hear your thoughts along what Wade said there. Why are we limiting versus allowing?
Fundamentally because of just exactly the point you landed on. State wildlife rules are generally written to preclude everything except a list of allowable weapon types, hunting seasons, everything. Your hunting seasons are excluded except for this open window. That's how our rules are constructed. To be consistent with the rest of state rules, that was the path we're headed down with this rule, and that's why the rule is constructed this way. There are, as you point out, other ways of constructing rules. That's not typically, to be consistent with the rest of state rule construction, that's not the way we've gone.
Wade, to respond to that, there's 99% of the species that live in Utah that the Division of Wildlife has management authority for aren't hunted. And so it's just as Russ says.
Gene, do you have a comment?
I'll make one.
I knew you wanted to.
I really think that what isn't broken shouldn't be, we shouldn't try to fix, and that the less regulation and the more freedom that we can provide, the better it is.
I think we're ready for a motion. Mike, Wade, somebody ready for a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept the falconry rule amendments as presented by the division, with the exception that's provided by the Utah Falconer Association, and we can just use that wording.
Yes. You guys have a copy of that? Okay. Do we have a second on the motion? Mike has a second. Do we have any discussion on the motion? All those in favor? Is that unanimous?
No. It's down here on the end.
Okay, you couldn't see Brian's. All those oppose?
America's opposed.
Okay, one opposed. Okay.
Weird place I find myself sometimes. Believe me, I was confused with the rest of it.
That is all that I have on the agenda. That was Mike Worthen.
Thank you.
Do you have any other business?
I do not.
I call this meeting adjourned.